Welcome to Prostate Cancer and You, a podcast produced by the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition, whose mission it is to educate, connect, and support men at risk, newly diagnosed individuals, survivors, and their families. It also connects organizations and professionals who seek to conquer and cure prostate cancer. I'm your host, Jordan Rich. On today's episode, we're talking with Dr. Adam Keibel, chair of the Department of Urology at Mass General Brigham. Our focus is on clinical trials and why people who fit the categories should consider being a part of them. We're going to talk with Dr. Keibel about one specific clinical trial that he's been involved with for many years, a trial seeking men of a certain age to help determine how genetic data and MRI can be used to improve the ability to detect prostate cancer early. This could ultimately help doctors understand, treat, and even prevent prostate cancer in the future. Details at rally, R-A-L-L-Y, massgeneralbrigham.org. Dr. Keibel begins by sharing the importance of clinical trials overall.
Let's just think about what medicine was like, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, 5 years ago. We're always improving our care of patients. And the reason why we're doing that is because what we do in 2025 is imperfect, just like it was imperfect in 2020, in 2000, in 1900. And what clinical trials allow us to do is learn, test, and then implement improved care for patients. All of us want to get better healthcare. Nobody wants to get healthcare that's 25 years old. And what clinical trials allow us to do is to develop those new management strategies to improve our care of patients.
For those people who are contemplating it and have fears, what should they know about clinical trials? Some people think that if I enroll myself in one, I might just be the subject of a placebo and not get any benefit or impact.
There was a lot in the question just asked. So the first thing is around fear. I think it's a leap of faith participating in a clinical trial. If we knew that the treatment or the management strategy worked, it wouldn't be a clinical trial. We'd be using it on everybody. Mm-hmm. So there is a little bit of a leap of faith that you're participating in something where you're going to get better care. As such, the placebo arm in the trial, when you're getting what would be the standard of care, because people, when you get a placebo, what that means is there is no standard of care. So in general, what you give is what you think is the best treatment currently versus the new treatment, which you think is better. So people who are getting the standard of care treatment frequently are getting the better care because the new treatment isn't actually better. That's why we're doing the study. There is a little bit of a leap of faith. It's important to recognize that there are a huge number of safeguards to ensure that patients get good care when they're in a clinical trial. The first thing is you don't have to participate. No reasonable, conscientious, thoughtful researcher expects people to participate in these trials. The first thing I do when I discuss these things with people is tell people, I will take care of you no matter what. Whether you participate in the clinical trial or not, you're going to get care. The second thing is that all these trials are reviewed by an IRB. It's an independent organization. And all they care about is patient safety. And it is really a high hurdle to get a trial through an IRB. They ensure there's a consent as part of that that tells the patient all the possible risks. And when I say all the possible risks, I mean all the possible risks. Sometimes I feel like those consents are like those ads at 2 o'clock in the morning telling people all the risks of drugs, which is unfortunate because most of the things aren't going to happen. The next thing is you can withdraw from a clinical trial at any point in time. And sometimes we withdraw people, we say, look, this isn't working for you. This is not your best care. Because ultimately, what our first responsibility is not to the trial, it's to you as a patient. So if you are having a problem to do with any clinical trial, whether you're getting a drug, whether you're getting a device, whether you're getting a different way of managing a patient, so it's not even a treatment, it's just a different way of following a patient. If you are not getting the best possible care, we decide to pull you out of it. The last thing is there's an independent body for many of the trials, not all of them, but many of the trials that looks at the data that is not me or the person who's actually running the trial, and they can pull the plug on the trial at any point in time. It's called the Data Safety Monitoring Committee. And I've served on many of these. And essentially, your sole role is to make sure that what's happening is safe for the patient. That independent assessment, both by the IRB beforehand and the Data Safety Monitoring Committee afterwards, along with you and the person you're working with on the clinical trial, ensures that you continue to get the best possible care.
Very gratifying information for sure. Now let's focus on the trial in question that you're excited about. And there's a website. I'll give the website early and often because you're looking for people to get involved. Rally, R-A-L-L-Y, .massgeneralbrigham.org. That's where you'll find the information. But what are we rallying around here?
Prostate, I mean, everybody listening to this podcast knows what a problem prostate cancer is. You know, number two, cancer killer. 3%, roughly, some people say 2% of American men are going to die of prostate cancer. And that's a huge, huge problem. Hidden in that statistic, okay, is that 97% of American men are not going to die of prostate cancer. And so when we're screening populations of men, we have a barrier in that we lose the wheat, the pin in the haystack, because we're worried that we'll overscreen men in one group and we'll underscreen the people who are actually at risk. So the idea of this study is by, and I'll describe it in a second, but the idea is to try and narrow the focus on the men that are more likely to be in that 3%. And the tool we're using is genetic testing. So many people have heard about BRCA1 and BRCA2, both in the context of prostate cancer and in the context of other malignancies. But those are pretty rare abnormalities. They exist in a very small percentage of the population. And we kind of know what to do with those patients. You screen them very aggressively, you biopsies, you know, those people we really understand are at high risk. There are other more subtle differences in all of our DNA that result in differences in hair color, differences in eye color, differences, you know, maybe in height, believe it or not. And also decreases or changes in your risk of cardiac disease, diabetes, and cancer. And increasingly, we're recognizing that by looking at all these small little changes, because it's not one or two like BRCA1 and BRCA2, we're talking about 100, 200, 300, 400 small little differences that pull you in one direction or the other. All of those can add up to identify people that are at higher risk for developing everything. Cardiac disease, diabetes, and cancer. So we have, along with a very large multinational group, developed a test to look at the risk of developing prostate cancer over someone's lifetime. And it's important to recognize over someone's lifetime, because DNA is the same when you're two as when you're 100. Doing what we want to do is use that test in order to identify, say, the top 25% of people that are at risk for developing prostate cancer and then dying of prostate cancer and then screening them very aggressively. Part of this study, what we're doing is we're taking everybody. We're not going to just look at the high-risk group because we don't know if this idea actually works. So we're going to look at the high-risk group, the average-risk group, and actually the low-risk group. We're going to get MRIs on all, so you get a genetic test. We get MRIs on all these patients. And then the people who are at who have an abnormality, an elevated PSA, an abnormality on the MRI, we're going to go ahead and do a biopsy. What we expect to happen, this is our hypothesis, is the people that are at high genetic risk and more likely to have prostate cancer, we're going to identify more prostate cancer, more prostate cancer that could cause them harm. And the people at average risk will find less, and the people at low risk will find almost none. And then you can turn around after the study and actually use it on patients. Somebody comes in, we do a genetic test, and we say, look, you're at no risk. You don't have to worry about prostate cancer. Think how nice that would be to the average guy walking around. Or you're at average risk, and we need to treat you like everybody else. Or you're at high risk, and we really need to be really intense in following you so we identify and treat this cancer before it causes you harm. Knowledge is power. And we're all walking around with a textbook inside of us called the DNA, which is going to tell us what's going to happen to us over the course of our lives. We want to go ahead and do a better job of reading that book and go ahead and tell patients what to expect when they get to the, you know, the end of the book. Maybe even make the book longer, right? Mm. That's the idea. Add a few chapters at the end.
Can you share with us some of the basic parameters? How many men are needed for the study? How long will the study go on?
So the study will go on until it's done. I'm pretty committed to this. I've been working on this for like 10, 20 years. This study has 1,500 men we want to enroll, both here in Boston and also in Washington, D.C. What we're going to do with each patient is, as I said, they get their blood drawn, check a PSA, do the genetic testing, get an MRI, and then we tell them the results. And then we decide on whether or not we should proceed with a biopsy on the basis of the of the MRI and the PSA testing. And then,
I was going to say,
and there is the idea that the people in the highest risk group will clearly offer to continue to follow them. The study is a snapshot in time. But again, this goes back to your earlier question about safety. It's really important. If we identify people that we think are in high risk group, we're going to follow them. We're going to keep tabs on them. And they don't have prostate cancer. We're going to keep an eye on them. While this study is designed to try and identify who has prostate cancer that's going to cause them harm, we're going to continue to follow the patients that appear to be at increased risk. We're not going to abandon them. We're going to talk to them about it. We're going to work with a plan with them that suits them in terms of their management in the future and ensure that they get, good care.
With the exciting advent of AI technology and the quick succession of technology in general and things moving so rapidly, I take it you're excited about the near future, not just the far future, the way things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, AI is going to help every facet of our lives, but it's particularly exciting in medicine. It'll help with the diagnosis. Patient comes in and they give a series of complaints, and AI helps us narrow it down very quickly to which test should order. It helps with very boring stuff like documentation, so the provider and the patient can spend more time talking to each other and not having to put everything down on a piece of paper. I think the biggest and most exciting stuff, it has to do with diagnostic tests. So if you get an MRI, you have an individual who reads it and looks at it and is highly trained. But leveraging AI to look at it and actually learn more than the human eye can see to identify who has a particular problem, it's mind-boggling and will lead to tremendous improvements in our ability to say who has a disease and who doesn't have a disease. I mean, people get very focused on the identifying of people who have a problem. But I think one of the biggest problems we have is clinical problems. People come in with an issue. Is it serious or is it not serious? And we could do a better job with that. So just use prostate cancer as an example. Somebody comes in with an elevated PSA and they have a negative MRI. Do they need a biopsy or not? What do we expect to happen in the future? Is the MRI going to get worse? Is it going to get better? Is the PSA going to go down or is it going to go up? AI is powerful enough as we move forward. This is not now, but I'm saying within a few years to tell us information about how worried the patient should be about their elevated PSA with a negative MRI. Is this in the future something's going to happen or is this just a blip and it's got nothing to do with cancer? And that'll be tremendously helpful to the patient and the clinician. Mm.
The appeal is on, the recruitment is on, and you need guys and their wives and girlfriends to step up. So I'd love you to make the public message, and then we'll make sure we give the appropriate contact information and web address again.
So we really want to get this study done. And the reason we want to get it done is because I want fewer men to die of prostate cancer. If we can do a better job of identifying men earlier in the disease state, maybe even before they're diagnosed, we can, change their diet, improve their ability to get screened more effectively, get the treatment before they have metastatic disease. It could be that radiation or surgery or maybe something like focal therapy. What I need is people to step forward and help us achieve that end. Women, encourage your husbands, boyfriends, partners to step forward because you love them and you want them to be with you, not for a year, but for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years. And taking good care of themselves involves improving our ability to diagnose a very serious disease, prostate cancer. What you're going to get out, what the patient's going to get out of it, is a potentially better screening paradigm, better screening. They're certainly going to get the standard of care right now, which is a PSA and an MRI. And everybody's going to get that. So everybody is going to get the best possible screening that they could get in 2025. And then in addition, we'll learn about whether the genetics can do a better job for them and all the other men in their lives, brothers, husbands, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now.
Well, MassPCC will be posting all of the connection points in the show notes and helping to promote this, of course. But why don't you tell us again the ways people can find out more, the website, the phone number, and even the email address. I'll let you.
So the website, as you already mentioned, was rally.massgeneralbrigham.org. is an email address that works quite effectively, which is BWH, Brigham and Women's Hospital, BWH, prostate genetic risk at mgb.org. I wish it wasn't such a mouthful, but BWH, prostate, which everybody should know, and then genetics is G-E-N-E-T-I-C, and then risk, R-I-S-K, all one word, at mgb.org. And then lastly, we do have a telephone number, 617-525-8782. I'll say that again, area code 617-525-8782. And you can call and leave a message.
One more clarifying question. The age of the participants.
Really important.
We didn't mention that, and I think it's important because we all know people in their 70s and 80s and even 60s, but there are people in their 30s and 40s who ought to consider this as well, right?
So really, we've set the age at 45 to 69 because that's the age group that is at risk for developing and dying of prostate cancer. In the end, the genetic testing could be really useful in people in their 30s, because we won't be able to diagnose people at that age. But if we find that this works and you're at increased risk, and we can tell people to alter their diet or something like that, so they're less likely to develop prostate cancer. I mean, that's the next study, is to prevent people from getting the disease in the first place. The inclusion criteria, which is important, is not only that age, but we don't want people who've had a recent biopsy. We don't want people who have prostate cancer. I realize a lot of people who listen to your podcast have cancer, and what they need to do is encourage their friends and loved ones who don't have cancer to participate in a study like this so that we can hopefully identify it earlier. But this study is on the screening side, not for men who already have the disease.
Certainly a lot to look forward to. Dr. Kaibel, as always, we thank you.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure. And thank you for all that you're doing. I think getting the message out about how important it is to be screened and treated is critical to our ability to improve the care of our the people we care about in our lives. And women are in general much more open about these kinds of issues around breast cancer and cervical cancer and ovarian cancer. And the work that you're doing is sort of opening a lot of men's eyes to the problems around prostate cancer and other men's health issues, which are just incredibly important to getting the message out.
We invite you to stay tuned to future podcasts featuring valuable information and resources, the latest in research and treatment, and stories of real people who have challenged prostate cancer and won. To learn more about the Massachusetts Prostate Cancer Coalition and to hear the Prostate Cancer and You podcast, again, go to masspcc.org. That's masspcc.org. You can also listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, and with all Android players. I'm Jordan Rich, wishing you a fabulous day.